This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who aspire to be. If you're a real estate, mortgage, or financial professional, this is the place for you. We'll explore innovative investment analysis, sales, marketing, and income-generating strategies for the most historically proven wealth creator, income property. Learn from the experts as they show you how to build a better business and a better life.
Welcome to the AIPIS show for accredited income property investment specialists and those who desire to be. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about increasing your income, your productivity, and just generally having a better life while serving your clients better with America's most historically proven asset class, income property. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds. It's my pleasure to welcome Gary Carmel to the show. He is president of CWS Capital Partners. He's author of The Philosophical Investor, Transforming Wisdom into Wealth. Gary, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jason. Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you on the show. I was going to turn that title around and say Transforming Wealth into Wisdom, which is unfortunately the way it goes for so many investors, right?
That is great, yes. I think there's an old Wall Street adage that says something like, if you're unwilling to change your mind, you'll have no change to mind.
There's a lot of quotes around this. You know, one is, you know, experience is the best teacher. Unfortunately, you can't get the lesson until you get the experience or something. I can't remember it, but, you know, it kind of goes along those same lines.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, you know, what the wise do at the beginning, the fools do at the end, or something like that. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A fool and his money are soon parted. Boy, we could have cliches for many minutes. You know, one I'll tell you is that you might really want to comment on is, you know, what happens when a general partner and a limited partner meet? At the beginning of that relationship, the general partner has all the experience and no money. The limited partner has the money and no experience. At the end, they change places.
Sadly, that's true. And, you know, we are in the business of being a general partner, and there is no greater responsibility and honor than the trust and fiduciary requirements you have to manage other people's money. And it really upsets me when I see that violated. And, you know, we've been in business since 1969 and have cultivated just many, many wonderful individual investor relationships over the years. And You have to be a trustworthy, credible firm built on integrity, values, and deliver results.
Yeah. So. There's a lot of bad apples out there, certainly. In fact, I just saw one in the paper yesterday. I can't remember the story, but, you know, this was a trader, like a Wall Street trader, taking off with a bunch of money. You know, these are cliche. I mean, it's almost one scandal a day on Wall Street, you know, which is why I like real estate better for sure. But, you know, tell us a little bit about the philosophical investor, if you would, and what is the sort of the thesis behind it, if you will?
Yeah, essentially, you know, I don't think it's a big surprise for people that are students of investing, but, you know, I've seen the enemy and it's in the mirror. So it's oftentimes ourselves. And what I have found is essentially it's very hard to overcome, you know, human nature that is susceptible to bouts of fear and greed. And oftentimes we do the suboptimal thing. And if you kind of look at the average investor return versus different asset classes, they tremendously underperform because they go in at the top and sell at the bottom. And so a philosophical investor to me is someone that learns from others, people like Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, George Soros, even Shakespeare, and I even tap into some musicians and artists and philosophers, and then you learn from yourself. And at the end of the day, what you try to do is marry the seminal experiences in your life from the wisdom that has been conveyed by others in a way that hopefully, like Odysseus did, you can tie yourself to the mast and avoid those terrible decisions.
The siren song.
And so, yeah, so that at the end of the day, and I would say one of the great quotes in the book is from a philosopher, Schopenhauer, German philosopher, and he said, you know, the task at hand is not to see what no one else sees, but to think what no one else thinks about that which everyone sees. So how do you prepare yourself to think very independently and control your emotions and make good decisions?
There, you know, that's such a good point. There's so much psychology to it. You know, we are our own worst enemy. You know, we've met the enemy and the enemy is us. Boy, we're full of cliches today, aren't we? Well, don't worry, listeners, we won't do that the whole episode, okay? I promise. But this really happens, you know, the most toward the end of a bull market in anything. And maybe that's what's going on in the stock market right now. You know, the tips from the shoe shine boy type thing where people, it's just so tempting when you see all of these people around you, you know, and you hear all of these stories about these big capital gains. You know, right now, you know, you're in my old hometown, you're in Orange County, California. I mean, you look at the real estate market in there and in other high price cyclical markets. I mean, you know, prices have been going crazy the last couple of years. And I used to play in that game. And now being a little older, wiser, more conservative, I just like the cash flow markets, you know, where properties appreciate in a more linear fashion and they just cash flow. So, you know, they're susceptible somewhat to the economic ups and downs, but it's not a major swing. You know, I'm not investing for appreciation. But that is the really tempting story, isn't it? Whether it be stocks, real estate, gold, Bitcoin, anything, right?
Right. Especially, you know, like you alluded to, when you hear about others doing well and you have the sense that maybe you're falling behind, you're so susceptible to want to jump in with the fray. And I think if you take a step back, respond and reflect rather than react. You develop certain investing cardinals, like you mentioned about cash flow. At least cash flow is a metric that can allow you to value assets sort of within a relevant range. You don't have to use your imagination so much. And so I think kind of sticking to things that you feel comfortable with, that have worked for you and you believe will continue to work, I think that makes a lot of sense.
I love the way you said that. Sticking with things where you don't have to use your imagination. You know, like your imagination says, oh my gosh, I'm going to make 30% in capital appreciation on this deal in a year. You know, that's not sustainable. I mean, can't we learn from history? You know, where everybody's susceptible to it, aren't they?
Yeah, and that's where the opportunity is too. If you can recognize those bouts of collective madness and I like to say monetizing the madness and stay out of the fray when everyone's going crazy and jump in when there's a lot of fear and despair, then one can really prosper. So, but we really do have to check ourselves to stay out of it when it gets crazy.
Yeah, we certainly do. Hey, tell us about the Munger moment. Munger is Warren Buffett's number two man, right?
Yeah, he is such a brilliant man. And at 90 or 91, he continues to just produce incredible thinking and investment results. And so there was something he said. He was describing a situation where they avoided a problem which everyone else fell prey to. And what happened was there was so much carnage that they had money and courage to step in when others didn't. And what he said was there are these very few opportunities that present themselves in one's life. But if they're recognized as such, where you, through analysis and using different variables and looking at the world sort of holistically and comprehensively, you can determine that the odds are overwhelmingly in your favor, then all you need is the courage and the capital to take advantage of that opportunity. And that capital has been generated because of patience and prudence in the past. So when everyone was jumping in and you stayed out of the fray, they lost money, you kept your money. Now you have one of these moments that I call a Munger moment, and they don't happen all the time. They're very few and far between, but when they occur, in the words of George Soros, you go for the jugular, and you really load the boat, and it can make a huge difference in one's life, financial outcomes in their life.
Can you give us an example of that?
I can. So our business, we own, operate, build apartment communities around the country. We have about 23,000 units or so, worth about $3 billion. So that's our business. So in the aftermath of the subprime debacle, we had seen there was so much excess going into housing finance that we kept saying that people are renters, but they don't know it because they started owning homes with no money down. And once those homes started losing value, they had negative equity. They basically were renting the homes from the bank. And we knew this was going to turn into a big problem. And that when we hit the recession, almost a near global depression, our indicators and way of looking at the world told us that renting was going to be not only, it was going to be necessary in the only form of new household formations because no single family housing essentially was being built. You couldn't get mortgage credit, and yet people needed to form new households and they needed to build and rebuild their credit, and they could do this through renting. And they had the flexibility to go where the jobs were. So that to us was a Munger moment. We said, we aren't going to see conditions like this for a very, very long time that are going to be so favorable to owning income-oriented apartment communities because the supply was contracting. And even though the demand was down, once the economy started to recover, the demand would explode and there would be a tremendous imbalance. And our thesis has generally turned out to be correct.
Okay, so in hindsight, you were correct. But here's the problem. Just like, you know, in any cycle, if we're looking at this graph and what we're mostly talking about here, by the way, you may not know this, but I differentiate real estate markets into three types. The linear market, that's the market that just sort of chugs along and does its thing, you know, averages 5, 6% appreciation annually over time. Then there's the cyclical market, that would be, you know, pretty much all of California, any high land value area, South Florida, the Northeast, those types of markets are cyclical. You know, they have big swings. You catch them right, you can make a fortune. You catch them wrong, you're dead. Okay.
Yeah, I call those high beta markets.
Yeah. High volatility, high beta markets, sure. And then there's the hybrid markets. And, you know, Phoenix would be a hybrid market where, you know, it kind of acted in a linear fashion for decades. And then in the last go round, you know, when we saw all this California money flowing into Phoenix and Nevada or Las Vegas and Phoenix, I do know the difference between cities and states, by the way, you know, those markets became really cyclical and really nutty, you know, just as California did. And, you know, in these different types of markets, the problem is when you're in the doldrums, when you're in that trough, you don't know that that's the bottom. Nobody does, right? And it's sort of easy to say now looking back, gosh, you know, we scooped up a bunch of deals, you know, in the worst part when all the news was bad and so forth. But how do you know when you're there, you know? I mean, after things went, you know, depreciated by 30-40%, sure, great deal. But how did you know they wouldn't go down another 10-20% beyond that, right?
Yeah, that's a very, very important, you know, question and you know, shrewd insight. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, or one of the things I convey in the book, is in my career at CWS, which has spanned nearly 30 years, I've been a fairly consistent writer of letters to our investors over particularly the last 15 years. And when I read investment books, just like you're saying, hindsight, you know, is 2020, of course. But what were people thinking in the moment? And the book conveys a lot of our thinking in the moment about how we were looking at the world, because you had to, it was a deep, dark time. There was a lot of fear and despair, and you didn't know if the light was the train coming at you or the light at the end of the tunnel. And so, you know, what were going to happen to multiples for real estate? Were they going to expand dramatically because the capital had exited? So we went through a lot of this thinking, and basically, I mean, I went back and tried to draw parallels to the 1920s and 30s and see how values responded back then. We looked at indicators. So by doing that, I actually got a level of comfort. I even looked at valuations of New York real estate in 1932, 33, 34, and they were very similar in their cap rates as to what they are today, and they didn't move much. So I thought that, okay, this is the depths of the depression. Valuations actually held up okay. But what we saw was a dramatic drop in transaction volume. You know, most people didn't sell. You didn't have the distress from the banks forcing foreclosures. So we then took a step back and said, one of the metrics we wanted to look at was replacement cost. You know, can we buy properties below replacement cost? And that gave us a level of comfort that we couldn't see much new supply until rents were significantly higher. So that was kind of check the box there. We were able to borrow at rates that offered us positive leverage. So we could buy a property at a 5 or 6% yield and borrow at 3. And we felt like there, you know, you were talking about cash flow, but that felt pretty safe to us. So even if we overpaid a little bit in the first couple of years, we could kind of earn ourselves or earn our way out. And there was such pessimism there, and there was no new supply of apartments because the banks were cutting back and they weren't lending to developers. So we just felt like there was the margin of safety was evolving. And the risk reward was so favorable. So you don't always know, of course, but we kind of put this mosaic together and said the odds were surely in our favor.
That makes sense to me. Now, let's talk about replacement cost issue for a moment. And then I want to make sure I don't forget to ask you about institutional investors and, you know, why they like certain types of properties over others, okay? But on the replacement cost issue, I think you are completely right. That's the same thing I was saying to my investors. In fact, I coined a new phrase for that. And I kind of try to make a distinction here between the concept of appreciation and what I call regression to replacement cost. So when you're buying below replacement cost, in other words, when it costs more to rebuild that property, in many cases a lot more, you know, than you can buy it for. You can buy it for much less than the cost of construction. I think that's a pretty safe bet. And apparently you do too. You know, do you want to just comment on my regression to replacement cost idea? Maybe, you know, to you, is that different than appreciation? I think it is. I think appreciation is when you're at, we'll call it par, where, you know, cost of replacement is equal to the cost of the property. But when it's below cost of replacement, I think that's really different than appreciation.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I think it's important to not use that as, it has to be somewhat of an adjusted indicator, because if you have a property that's 20 years old, of course that should be below, you know, something new, because it just is not, you know, as amenitized or may not have functionality. Right. So adjusting for age is very important.
Yeah, it's not new.
And,
yeah, I understand.
Right. That's just, we just feel so much safer knowing that a developer is going to have a hard time getting financed unless, and earning the economic returns to justify the risk, unless the income in that area or the rents have gone up. And so if our rents are 20 or 30% below replacement cost, and the asset value is, you know, significantly below replacement cost, that is just a very good place to be. You've hedged your risk, and the upside should kind of take care of itself with the apartments filling up, the rents growing to justify new construction. You know, by those events occurring, as I said, the appreciation should materialize.
Yep, I would agree. So let me ask you about the appetite for institutional investors. So first of all, you would consider yourself an institutional investor, right? Your company?
Yes, I would. I'd say, well, we have institutional capabilities, depth, track record, strength, but we're generally financed by private investors. So when I think of institutional investors, I think of them being, you know, getting their money from the public markets or pension funds and endowments and things like that. So just the subtle distinction there. But sophistication, yes.
Yeah, fair enough. And I sort of put it by price point, you know, amount of money. In the apartment world, you know, a lot of people on the lending side sort of consider anything over $8 million, $7-8 million to be sort of where you get into that more institutional type stage, where it's, you know, it's not the rich guy, the you know, the millionaire next door type, right? Thomas Stanley wrote about that's buying those things. That's just too big for him. Why is it? And it's always perplexed me a little bit. I think it's just because of sort of safety and simplicity. Why is it that the institutional investors always go for these Class A types of properties with low cap rates, low yields? You know, that's what you guys do. You do luxury apartment complexes. And, you know, look, you're in the bastion of the Irvine Company, right? One of the biggest apartment owners in the country. And it's always... the Class A type stuff where you've got these low cap rates. Are institutional investors just not into, you know, a little bit of handiwork, re-tenanting, raising the value? They just like that higher quality stuff always. But, you know, it has lower yields, you must admit, right?
Right. I think it has something to do with generally the very long-term horizon that they have in terms of the money or the liabilities that they're responsible for generating returns against. And there is a lot of historical data that shows that apartments generally offer fairly compelling returns with less volatility, and they can store their wealth in these really high-end communities that tend to generally do, you know, reasonably well over time. And so I think that the historical data tends to support that strategy for them. And they have a lot of capital to place. They like quality, right? It's just not, they're big, and they don't have a lot of time and manpower to manage these very creative, complex opportunities oftentimes. And so it really is a risk-reward, profile. So I don't know if that answered, but that's our experience.
Sure. I understand. So the demographics coming at the rental market, I mean, you know, in my company, we like housing. The demographics coming at the rental market over the next decade are, in my opinion, pretty phenomenal. Maybe the best they've ever been in history. I mean, you've got Generation Y, the largest demographic cohort in U.S. history, slightly larger than the baby boomers by about 4 million. And the baby boomers just changed the planet. I mean, an amazing spending curve. You've got that generation is largely saddled by over $1 trillion in student loan debt that is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. They are literally debt slaves. And I have a whole philosophical opinion about that, but that's another discussion maybe. And then, you know, they're delaying family formation. They're delaying marriage. They like mobility. As I always say, the best thing you can have on a resume is mobility, to go where the jobs are. And all those and many other factors make them kind of like ideal renters. You know, one more factor I'll throw in and you can comment on is that a lot of them, they were going through their sort of formative years at a time where they saw their parents get burned in the housing market and the recession. And they're like, you know, I don't really care about a house with a picket fence and, you know, being tied to one location so much. You know, I think, you know, and also just there's it's kind of a technological component that makes people very mobile, obviously, nowadays. I mean, I can run my business from any place in the world. Just, you know, less than a decade ago, I kind of felt like I needed a big office and a big staff and a location and a sign on the building. And I don't feel like I need that at all nowadays. And I think a lot of people are, you know, there's a lot of mobile entrepreneurs nowadays. So those and, you know, other factors, if you have any you'd like to add to it, I think make a pretty great opportunity for landlords, right?
Yeah. What you described is exactly, I mean, I think you covered every positive characteristic that, you know, I talk about in terms of the long wave that should be benefiting renting and landlords. I guess with the student loans, you know, you mentioned about the debt slaves that makes it very difficult to get mortgages. The mortgage market still is not anywhere what it was in terms of how open it is. And as you mentioned, delayed marriages. There's also an interesting, demographic or sociological statistic that there are so many more women who are graduating from college and have graduated from college than men, that there's this big educational gap, which supposedly might be contributing to delays in marriage, which is kind of an interesting thing to think about. There is the whole reurbanization phenomenon where, you know, people want to be in these city centers, and there's a lot of walkability, and early on, there's not much home ownership down there. And as you said, I think the return on mobility and flexibility has never been higher. It is a, I like to say that apartments prosper from insecure growth. In other words, the economy is growing, it's producing jobs, households are being formed, but people just feel a little bit insecure about how long they're going to be somewhere. And do they really need to be tied down? You know, what if I have to sell in 2 years and all those transaction costs?
And all the hassle. I mean, don't underestimate the hassle. You know, I, for literally almost all my life, except one portion, I was a homeowner. I owned many homes in Irvine, you know, Newport. You know, I lived in all those areas, right? Newport Coast, I mean to say. You know, it's a monumental hassle to, you know, put your house on the market, have your privacy invaded, keep it clean every day. I mean, it's just that's a job. You know, living in an apartment, you just give 30 days notice and you're done. It's so easy.
It's really true. And we think about it, when we upgrade an apartment, we could literally have it done in 5 days or something. Imagine doing that to your house. I mean, of course it's yours and there's private ownership, but it's just so efficient too. And I just, there's so many stories of people, right, that they took a risk with their career or starting a business because they weren't tied down by a mortgage. There's actually a line in the movie, Thank You for Smoking, that says, I'm just going to paraphrase, but he says something like, all problems can be traced back to having a mortgage. I mean, it was kind of a very funny line in the context, but you know, it really does tie you down. And it's, of course, it's right for certain people at their stage in life. But boy, when you're younger and you want to advance in your career and you want to show how flexible you can be, I mean, it's highly valuable to an employer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no question about it. Yeah. Are there any holes in my theory? You know, I mean, see, the funny thing is, you know, like the thank you for smoking line that you paraphrased, you know, all problems stem from having a mortgage. See, I think it's great to have a mortgage on income properties that you rent to other people. But oddly, renting can be a very convenient thing for oneself. I mean, those would seem to contradict each other, but I don't think they do. You know, I own lots of properties and I'm personally a renter and I like that. I think it's great.
Yeah, right. I would agree with you. I think it's when you have something that limits your flexibility and the options you can have in life, look, you know, some people can easily handle a mortgage on their primary residence. I don't want that to apply to every single person. But the point is, there's a time in your life where the last thing you want to do is limit your optionality. And on mortgages on income-producing property makes sense all day long because of the leverage and the tax benefits.
I love leverage, and I love what I call inflation-induced debt destruction, where, and I want to ask you your outlook, where in inflationary environments, basically the inflation pays off your debt for you. You know, it's not only your tenants that are paying down your debt, but your inflation is. So that's a great thing too. Which leads me to another question for you. Where do you think we're going? I mean, what's your forecast for the economy? Is it, you know, mainly on the, you know, monetary side, inflation, deflation, stagnation, some other hybrid? What do you think?
Well, I was never in the camp, and I might have been in the minority in 2009-10 when we had trillion-dollar deficits for a few years, that was going to lead to a real spiral in inflation and higher interest rates. I felt like there was such demand destruction in the economy that actually the government had to step in and be kind of the source of demand. And it's not an ideological argument. It's just how I saw how the economy works. And so we clearly come out the other side. The global economy is so competitive. I think there was a sea change in 81, 82 when Reagan took over and the tax laws were changed. And we've become such a shareholder-focused economy and financialized economy that it tends to come at the expense of, you know, wages and the feeling of security in one's job. And you add to that the global forces and the, you know, the competition that arises there. And I look at global yields right now and I see, you know, Germany 10-year yields at 30 basis points or whatever, and Japan at a similar rate, Switzerland at negative rates. And we have some of the highest rates in the world. And we're seeing already what's happening to the dollar as there's, you know, concerns or there's indications the Fed might start raising rates. And it's starting to impact our export industries. The price of oil coming down, while beneficial for some, is hurting other areas of the economy now that we've been producing so much oil. So I am still in the camp that rates are going to remain quite low for a considerable period of time. I just don't see how the Fed presses on, the brakes without doing some damage. And so, yeah, that's kind of my macro thinking right now.
So does that have to ultimately, like you said, at the time, it was okay to have the QE. You know, you felt that way because the powers that be just had to step in. But I mean, do you think that ultimately that has to show up in inflationary pressure, or is it just different, where the government can print and, the government and the Fed, I guess, it's sort of this little dynamic between the Treasury and the Fed. And they can do that without any real consequences, inflationary consequences? Or does that ultimately, at some point, have to rear its ugly head or its profitable head for investors with debt and real estate?
Right. Well, I actually talk about that fairly extensively in my book, the thinking behind why I didn't think rates were going to go higher. And I do think that people misread the situation. It does appear on the surface that it was printing money, but really all the Fed was doing an asset swap. They would press buttons on a computer and people would sell their treasuries to the Fed, and the Fed would exchange that for cash. So suddenly you're taking interest income out of the economy. And now the people had cash and they could do what they would with it. So it's sitting in, a lot of this money is sitting in reserves in the banking system. But the banks, the only reason they don't lend, they're not really, they would have to either be capital constrained, which they're not, they have plenty of capital now, or they really need qualified borrowers, to compensate them for the risk. And we're not seeing just a lot of demand out there for borrowing. I mean, there is in the junk bond world and all that stuff, but a lot of the capital is going to pay dividends and to buy back stock, and it's not necessarily going into the real economy. So I guess if there were profitable opportunities for businesses to really invest aggressively, and that created, now on the other hand, when they do that, that creates more supply capacity in the economy. And to me, you really start having inflation when demand far exceeds the supply capacity of the economy. And so I know I'm getting a little technical there, but I don't see it on the horizon. I think if businesses wanted to borrow more aggressively, and the banks would be willing to do that, or said differently, if the banks had qualified borrowers on the consumer side and on the business side, there's plenty of capital to do that. So it's a complicated topic, but it's something I'm not really fearful of right now. And let me add one more thing as to why I believe that to be the case. The demographic structure of the developed world is really aging, and we're seeing a slowdown in labor force growth, and that is generally not an inflationary environment. If you look at how rates performed in the late 70s, early 80s, that was at the same time we had tremendous numbers of new people entering the labor force who were not very productive, and they suddenly had all of this demand in the economy, and then you overlay the oil spike with OPEC, and I just don't see a lot of those same conditions.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. We shall see. We shall see which way it goes. Give out your website, if you would. Very interesting conversation.
Yeah, thank you. So there's two of them. The firm is CWScapital.com, and then I have a personal one, GaryCarmel.com, and it's got a lot of my, blog. I write something every week, and then the book is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's, as you said, it's called The Philosophical Investor, Transforming Wisdom into Wealth.
Good stuff. Gary, I just want to ask you on that last note, when it looks like you're not fearful of inflation, at least not for a while. You know, in terms of investor strategy related to inflation, deflation, stagnation, are you fearful of deflation?
Well, not necessarily to me, deflation would result if you had a material depreciation of asset values, because there has been a lot of borrowing for, you know, real estate and, you know, junk bonds and, you know, to pay dividends and share buybacks. So if there was some sea change in the credit markets where suddenly these debt couldn't be repaid and the asset values dropped, that's kind of the deflation I would ultimately be fearful of. Not so much consumer prices dropping. You know, I think they're kind of click along at maybe the, you know, 1.5%, 2.5% level. So because we're so financialized and a lot of people have their net worth tied to investments, that's the risk that I see.
So financialized, like you said, the shareholder economy, I know we have to wrap up, but I just want to let you explain that thought, if you would.
So there are businesses that are very profitable, a Qualcomm, for example, and yet they, you know, they're buying back stock, they're paying dividends, they have high profit margins. Now their business is a little under pressure, and they're probably going to, you know, restructure and lay off people in one of the more profitable businesses. And it's the activist investor. It's the pressure for high returns on capital and capital efficiency and global choices where you can put your money and hire labor and, you know, hire people. And so that is a scenario that I keep saying is creates this insecure growth where, you know, just being apartment oriented, I do think it gives people a tendency to rent for longer periods of time than they otherwise would. And I just think it reduces maybe the bargaining power that labor has, generally speaking. And so, which keeps those inflationary pressures maybe lower than they otherwise would be.
Okay, so in terms of investor strategy, I think the real estate investor, especially the one with leverage, hits a home run in an inflationary environment. I mean, that is just a home run, huge home run. In a deflationary or stagnationary environment, I think it's really just a game of yield. You know, that's what we've seen to some extent over the past couple of years. I mean, it's sort of like we've got all these different things going on at the same time, but it's a game of yield largely. And that yield, there's just no place to get it. I mean, the real estate, the cash flowing real estate is really one of the few places you can get yield, right?
Yeah. And that's where we are probably maybe a little counterintuitive or controversial is we have been borrowing very, very aggressively using variable rate loans. And most people that are in the real estate world, including most homeowners.
That's one where I would just think you're crazy, but go ahead and explain.
Yeah. Right. So I have a chapter in the book that says it's called Go Variable, Young Man, and all the reasons why. But in our world, there is, when you borrow at a fixed rate, it generally starts off, the fixed rate is about roughly 2 points higher than your variable rate starting off. So, of course, you are taking interest rate risk, but that 2% makes a big difference, you know, especially if you're borrowing, you know, $25 million like we may. But I do this on my personal investments as well, so I'm eating my own cooking. So all my personal real estate has variable rate financing on it.
Wow, you're one of the few. I mean, like nobody in the industry agrees with you on that, do they?
Right, exactly. That's right. And I kind of like that, the contrarian in me. But really, what I don't want to get too technical, but in our world, when you borrow at fixed rates and you want to pay that loan off early, you often are subjected to very large prepayment penalties, because the lender wants to be compensated as if they had their money out the entire time. They don't want to get it back early. On variable rate loans, there's a very insignificant prepayment penalty. So we have a lot of optionality in terms of selling or refinancing. And a lot of our variable rate loans can be converted to fixed.
I want to make that distinction for the listeners, if we could. You know, and I own apartments and single family homes, and on large apartment loans, they very often come with big prepayment penalties. In fact, we just paid one on a deal we sold for over $8 million in Arizona. That's not the case in the typical 30-year fixed rate Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac type mortgage that a single family home or a fourplex buyer would get. So I think you do need to make that distinction. So there is some real logic behind your philosophy there. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right that in the single family world, in, you know, 1 to 4 units, those you're not nearly as constrained with prepayment restrictions as we are. But what I would still say is oftentimes, the average tenure in a home is clearly less than 30 years and oftentimes less than 10. And so, but with that, there are other options like a 5-year fixed and then adjustable or 7 years. So I really don't, for me, and one of the things I say in the book is I talk about courage, and courage is knowing what not to fear. And for me, I don't fear materially higher rates. We buy interest rate caps, and I feel like the positive leverage that I'm getting is worth the risk, and I can, use that excess cash flow and do other things with it. And so it is not for everybody. I do explain why it's for us in the book and our thought process, but I completely understand why it's, we'd be in the deep minority.
Gary, very interesting discussion. I know we went a little long, but you were interesting. I hope you don't mind. And again, thank you for joining us. You gave out the websites, and we just appreciate having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much. It was my sincere pleasure.
You know, sometimes I think of Jason Hartman as a walking encyclopedia on the subject of creating wealth.
Well, you're probably not far off from the truth, Penny, because Jason actually has a 3-book set on creating wealth that comes with 60 digital download audios.
Yes, Jason has that unique ability to make you understand investing the way it should be. It's a world where anything less than 26% annual return is disappointing.
I love how he actually shows us how we can be excited about these scary times and exploit the incredible opportunities this present economy has afforded us.
We can pick local markets untouched by the economic downturn, exploit packaged commodities investing, and achieve exceptional returns safely and securely.
I also like how he teaches you to protect the equity in your home before it disappears and how to outsource your debt obligations to the government.
And the entire set of advanced strategies for wealth creation is being offered at a savings of $94.
That's right. And to get your Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series, complete with over 60 hours of audio and 3 books, just go to jasonhartman.com/store.
If you want to be able to sit back and collect checks every month, just like a banker, Jason's Creating Wealth Encyclopedia series is for you. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.